Good afternoon and welcome to Memorial Medical Center Pathology Teleconference. Today's program is entitled Too Much of a Good Thing. We will begin with a formal presentation given by our speaker, followed by a discussion period at the end of the program. Please remember to mute your speakerphone by pressing the mute button on your speakerphone or by pressing the pound key followed by the number 5 key on your speakerphone. The speaker for today is Dr. Chad Dufresne. At Memorial Medical Center, Dr. Dufresne is the Assistant Chair of the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology. He is also an Associate Professor at the Department of Pathology at SIU School of Medicine and a member of the Pathology Associates of Central Illinois. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Dr. Dufresne.
Thanks, Robin. Just one clarification. I'm honored, but actually I'm not an associate professor with SIU, but thanks anyway. So actually this talk is called Too Much of a Good Thing, A Woman with Hypertension and Hypokalemia. And actually, rather than a talk, this is essentially a case study that I thought was pretty interesting. I saw it in a clinical chemistry journal a few months back, and I thought it would make a great presentation for us to look at it a little bit and just to remember sort of an unusual finding that can sometimes occur and that we may be, you know, some of us might be asked about in the lab. So I'm looking at slide 2, the title slide, and I'm going to go ahead and advance to slide 3, and I don't have a lot of introduction or anything. We're just going to go right into it. So the history was that a 64-year-old woman who had a history of paranoid schizophrenia was presenting to her outpatient clinic with just a basic follow-up, routine follow-up or exam, and she didn't really have any specific complaint. She did have a history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and although I don't think she complained about it, they ultimately found that she also was hypokalemic, and her medications did include from elsewhere oral potassium supplementation and Zyprexa, which is a medication. I think it's an antipsychotic medication. You want to go ahead and look at slide number 4. On physical examination, the patient looked well, but the most significant finding was that her blood pressure was quite elevated at almost 190 over 105. So some basic labs were drawn, and she had sodium within reference range at 142, BUN was 8, creatinine was 0.6, magnesium, also we'll keep track of that, was 2.4, glucose was normal at 94, her bicarb was a little bit elevated at 43, so she's a little bit alkalemic, and the reference interval for that would be 22 to 32, and then of course her potassium was quite low at 1.9. So before we go on much farther with the history and what ultimately happened to the patient, I thought it might be useful to discuss hypokalemia at a very basic level. I think we get so far down the track of laboratory medicine that sometimes we forget a little bit about the basic stuff. So if we think about hypokalemia in a general approach to why a patient is hypokalemic, there are three possibilities, or three general possibilities in the differential. Number one is the patient isn't taking in enough potassium, so decreased intake. Number two, increased loss, or the patient is somehow losing potassium, which, as it turns out, is really the most common cause of hypokalemia. So most of the time, clinically, that's what we focus on. And then third, redistribution of potassium from the serum into say into cells, so that the serum potassium actually looks low. So decreased intake is really pretty uncommon now. The only times you would see decreased intake is with extreme starvation or occasionally clay ingestion, which is also not a common thing that we see much anymore, or pica, P-I-C-A, that's referred to as. That was more common, I think, years and years ago in the South, where I think particularly or occasionally pregnant women or people with anemia would ingest clay. The clay actually binds potassium and iron, I think, and so they become hypokalemic. But I think that's pretty unusual to see that much anymore today. But where we live most of the time clinically is going to be in this area with increased loss. And so if we break down increased losses into renal and non-renal categories, that's also a helpful way to try and figure out a problem with a patient. Now, the non-renal losses we can pretty much figure out just based on a patient's clinical history. The patient's complaining of GI losses such as diarrhea, or if you know they've been doing a lot of sweating, well, then that kind of gets us into that ballpark. So again, most of the losses we're going to look at revolve around the renal side. And these are the things that these patients don't always think about, and we as physicians don't always think about, and laboratory professionals. So on the renal side, we have diuretics, especially loop diuretics. Thiazide diuretics are common offenders here. Osmotic diuresis, such as that seen in hyperglycemia, some of the most unusual potassiums you can see would be in a patient with diabetic ketoacidosis. Hyperaldosteronism is also another common cause. We don't always think about the endocrine side of things, but especially in this patient where we have an abnormality, both the blood pressure and an electrolyte abnormality, we really have to start thinking about endocrine abnormalities. Hyperaldosteronism would be a big one. Something called apparent hyperaldosteronism is also considered, and that is where the patient doesn't have elevated aldosterone, but they may have other metabolic abnormalities which effectively create a hyperaldosteronistic state. Then congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Cushing syndrome, Barter syndrome. I think this Barter syndrome and Little syndrome, I think those are problems with sodium-potassium channels that are inherited genetic defects in the kidneys. So those have a little bit of a different presentation. Vomiting and hypomagnesemia is one another one that we also don't think of. Anytime there's a hypokalemia, we always have to take a step back, at least take a look at magnesium, because patients who are hypomagnesemic can also become hypokalemic, and the hypokalemia corrects best after their magnesium is corrected. So in this patient, of course, we did note that the patient was had a normal magnesium within the reference range. The third thing is redistribution of potassium into cells. And I'm sure a lot of this is going to be review, but I'm sure as we go over some of these things that might ring a bell for you. I know this all brought back a lot of biochemistry and stuff for me going over this, but metabolic alkalosis is a common cause for potassium to shift back into cells. And as you see on the bottom I'm on number 9 here. Sorry, I think I'm moving ahead without remembering to tell you the slides. But on slide number 9, at the bottom of the illustrative cell there, there's a hydrogen-potassium transporter. And when there's acid-base disturbances, potassium can shift back and forth from the cell in order to shift the hydrogen ion or the proton back and forth to try and balance that out, because the body, of course, wants to remain in homeostasis. So it's going to try and correct for that acid-base abnormality, and unfortunately, potassium sometimes loses there. Insulin also drives potassium into cells, and beta-2 adrenergic agonists can also drive potassium into cells. And I think if you think about that a little bit, for muscles and whatnot to work well, they need that potassium. So if there's an adrenergic impulse, then the potassium shifts into cells for that reason. Let's see. The one point about this redistribution into cells is it's usually not a major shift, and it's usually you'll only see potassium decrease by about one at the most with these kind of shifts. So if a patient is down more than that, you really have to think about other things. And once again, pointing us back to the point about increased loss of potassium, and typically that revolves around renal losses. Okay, so looking at slide 10 now, let's follow up and see where our patient landed here. So back in the patient was actually sent to the emergency department because of a critically low potassium. So in the ED, the patient was persistently hypertensive, and review of the patient's prior records was also followed up on. The patient was known to be hypokalemic at least in a couple times in the past and the labs that they were able to look at. So, of course, with potassium abnormalities, one of the first things they want to do in the ED is put the patient on the heart monitor. And so her her ECG was normal. Upon further interview, the patient, and this is where we're looking at more of the history, because as we noted, we can get at a lot of, we can rule out a lot of things just based on the patient's history with hypokalemia. So the patient wasn't using diuretics. There was no use of laxatives. She hadn't been on a prolonged fast, so they weren't worried about starvation. She didn't have any diarrhea or vomiting that she complained about either. And the repeat serum potassium in the ED was also 2.1 millimoles per liter, and the calculated serum osmolality was right around 300. And the reason they did that is going to become clear in a little bit as we look at a clinical approach to hypokalemia. So osmolality is a little bit important. And unfortunately, I really forgot to put a slide in here on one of the important points I wanted to make about this talk, and we'll get to that in a second, but it's going to be about this transtubular potassium gradient that can be helpful in trying to decide what the problem is with the patient's hypokalemia. So again, if we look at this is just another illustration as to how to think about hypokalemia, and you can see this is slide 10, by the way. So you can see at the top of the flow chart or algorithm here that redistribution into cells and decreased potassium intake, they try to rule those out right away. And then after that, excessive potassium losses go into GI and renal. Well, a quick way in the lab to decipher between those two is just to check a urinary potassium. And I know they say, greater than 20 to 30 millimoles per day on the renal losses, or less than 20 to 30 millimoles per day for the GI losses. But in this case, I think we're going to get the patient's urine potassium in a little bit here. And it's so elevated that we know she's losing potassium through her kidneys. So really didn't need a 24-hour urine potassium. And a lot of times that's the case where a 24-hour urine potassium is not really necessary. If we go to slide 12, this is an algorithm that's actually from Harrison's textbook of internal medicine. And if you look at the top, basically they start also with urinary potassium excretion, and they do it less than 15 or greater than 15 millimoles per day. And then from there, they look at acid-base status and as well as potassium secretion is also evaluated by, you'll see it's this TTKG, which is transtubular potassium gradient. And this is an equation that involves the serum osmolality, urine osmolality, serum sodium, and serum potassium and urine potassium. It's kind of similar to, I think we can also do something similar with sodium. I'm blanking on that a little bit right now. But anyways, that's what they used actually in this article was this transtubular potassium gradient. And because the gradient turned out it was greater than 4 in this patient. So then we moved on to acid-base status. She was in the metabolic alkalosis camp. And then they looked at hypertension. Of course, she had it. And if you look at the bottom there, she did have hypertension. So two things they call our attention to would be mineral corticoid excess and Liddle syndrome. Now, again, Liddle syndrome, I think, didn't fit the clinical picture. I think it tends to take place in a little bit younger patients, and I'm not sure if the hypertension is to the level that we see in this patient. So anyway, so that was ruled out. So essentially, we're left with mineral corticoid excess, at least in this algorithm. And it turns out the case is a little bit more complicated than that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been that interesting to do this presentation on. So anyways, we look at a couple more things here. The patient's urine creatinine, sodium, potassium, and osmolality. And you'll note that the urine potassium is really high here. So again, we can tell that the patient is losing potassium through the urine. And you might ask, what's normal for these, or what's the reference range for the urinary analytes here? And that's a really hard thing to put a handle on. It's really, you have to look at these values in reference to the serum values, because the kidney should be able to sort of find a homeostatic balance for whatever the serum looks like. So anyway, so you really have to look at these values in terms of what the serum looks like. So this patient, again, was placed on constant cardiac monitoring and was given IV and oral potassium supplementation. And they also did an aldosterone and renin, because we also want to rule out hyperaldosteronism. So they looked at aldosterone, renin as well. Okay. So now we go to slide 14. And again, I'm back in the increased loss area here, and I've sort of crossed out all the things that we've ruled out already. And in the renal side, diuretics, osmotic diuresis, hyperaldosteronism, we got a morning aldosterone, ruled that out. Apparent hyperaldosteronism, well, we haven't ruled that out yet. Even though her aldosterone was normal, we can't rule out this concept of apparent hyperaldosteronism. And let's see, Bartter syndrome, vomiting, hypomagnesemia, and Liddle syndrome, we also ruled those out. So I thought it'd be interesting on slide 15 to talk a little bit about Cushing syndrome, just as a review, if not as much for you guys as for myself and preparing for the talks. I like to learn something from these two. So if you look at slide 15, I thought this was kind of funny but kind of a sad picture at the same time. This is actually a dog, a dachshund with Cushing syndrome. And a couple of the main points here is that you see this sort of truncal or midsection central adiposity, as well as sort of limb wasting. If you think of dogs, normally they have pretty thick hind leg muscles. This dog, her legs are pretty wasted here. So, but before we get too far into talking about Cushing's, it's probably important on slide 16 that we just review this the HPA axis. And it's starting from the top of this diagram. This is the simplest diagram I could find. If you look at what goes on with this axis, so the hypothalamus produces CRH, or corticotropin-releasing hormone, which then acts on the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland produces ACTH, which then acts on adrenal cortical cells, and those adrenal cortical cells produce cortisol. Okay? So this is what we want to keep in mind as we go throughout the rest of the talk, and I'm not going to talk about this little thing on the right if you push your mouse again here, but that just shows how cortisol kind of, it's not a constant concentration in the blood, but kind of fluctuates throughout the day. And on slide 17, actually, I'm just borrowing some slides from this Cushing's Important Research Foundation, because I thought, why reinvent the wheel here? So on the left, I like these slides because they show some pictures of these are the same patient on the left hand side here. So the one at the bottom is the patient, same patient without Cushing's. One at the top is the patient with Cushing's prior to diagnosis. So you can see that she has this typical, what they call a moon facies, where her face appears really puffy, kind of rounded, and you can appreciate how life-changing this is to diagnose this for these patients when you look at the patient at the bottom. She's a different person. So what is Cushing's? So, of course, Cushing's is hypercortisol in them. It's an elevation of cortisol that is related either to either too much production of ACTH it's either ACTH independent or dependent. So if you have too much ACTH production, that, again, stimulates the adrenocortical cell to produce cortisol. Sometimes you have adrenocortical tumors that also produce cortisol as well. So those would be ACTH independent. Okay, going again to slide 18 here. Again, you see some interesting pictures on the right. You can, once again, appreciate how dramatically different these people look after they've been diagnosed and treated. And on the left-hand side, when you think of Cushing's, there are some very common physical signs that you think of. We'll just go through the main ones. Of course, moon facies is one we've already talked about. Osteoporosis can be particularly problematic. What they call a buffalo hump is due to the redistribution of adipose tissue that these people undergo, where a lot of the adipose goes to the upper back, to the supraclavicular region, as well as to the central parts of the body, whereas then you get kind of wasting of the peripheral limbs. Let's see. Thin, wrinkled skin is something we also see, and that's due to, the disruption in the collagen. And because of that, these people get what are called abdominal stria, and these are sort of purplish stretch marks, essentially, in the skin. And that's because that the thin skin that they get due to the hypercortisolism. Muscle weakness is also a problem, and poor wound healing as well for these patients. Moving along to slide number 19, you see some of these stria in a gentleman with marked central adiposity. So this is because, the skin gets pretty thin here, and they get these really broad stretch marks quite easily. Moving to slide number 20, I don't recall exactly where I got this. There is a reference in the middle right-hand side there. But anyways, I just liked how this illustration kind of points out the various ACTH-dependent and independent means by which you can get cortisol or hypercortisolism. And actually, the most common cause of this in the lower left-hand corner is actually exogenous corticosteroids. So people who take corticosteroids for a long period of time can actually sort of induce a Cushingoid type syndrome. So if you look at the top, again, we can see in the pituitary, the main cause here is going to be one of these corticotrope adenomas, and that's going to produce too much ACTH, which stimulates the adrenal gland to produce too much cortisol. Now, aside from that, you can also have paraneoplastic syndromes, and the classic ones we think of are like carcinoid or small cell tumors of the lung. But I think last I had read in one of our main pathology textbooks in Robbins, it actually says that squamous cell is more frequently produces these paraneoplastic syndromes, I believe. And so again, if you go down to the middle of the chart here, you can see adrenal cortical adenomas or adrenal hyperplasia or adrenal carcinoma. These can also cause this hyperadrenal cortisolism. And sometimes the problem is, like with this picture in the middle with adrenal hyperplasia, you don't always have a discrete nodule that you see. There might just be little hyperplastic foci of cortisol-producing cells. So that becomes a little bit more challenging to diagnose that way. But again, those are ACTH independent because they just start to, those tumors start to function on their own. And actually, ACTH would be depressed in those cases. So there are lots of ways to diagnose Cushing's. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with these. I'm just going to go to slide 22 because it points out a couple of the most common ways to diagnose Cushing's. And more these days, I think, and I'm not sure what our endocrinologists do here, but more and more these days, I think it's becoming common to use a late-night salivary cortisol. And that's where the patient gets a swab at home, and they can take a salivary sample at home, and if that's normal, as well as some of these other things, you're probably able to exclude the possibility of hypercortisolism. Probably a more definitive test is going to be the 24-hour urine free cortisol. So that's basically the first step in your diagnosis of Cushing's, is you have to figure out, does the patient have high cortisol to begin with? And, of course, we do it at night because of the way that cortisol is, has kind of pulsatile activity, and that's I think that's when it's at its lowest is at night. So you want to measure it then in order to judge that it's elevated above even during its lowest time. Let's see. So slide 23 is another really complicated slide and hard to focus on. If you push your arrow again, it will highlight this ACTH independent side of this diagnosing Cushing's. But at the top, you can measure ACTH, and then actually, I'm just going to skip over this slide. I think I was probably a little over ambitious and spending too much time on this. You guys can look at it later, and we're not obviously clinicians, so I think we can probably go ahead and skip that for now. After a lot of these things are done, sometimes I think this is a very rare test that they do, but it's just more of an interesting thing to look at on slide 24, the inferior petrosal sinus sampling. You may or may not have heard of that. But basically, it looks at ACTH secretion in the pituitary gland, and it looks at it. I think they're trying to decide which side of the pituitary gland is putting out this ACTH, and you look at that relative. You look at this petrosal sinus sampling specimen relative to what the peripheral blood is doing to get an idea of which side of the pituitary is producing the overactive ACTH. Yeah. And let's see, some other, on slide 25, these are just some other ways that, a description of some more of the tests that look at, as we've already talked about, late night salivary test, 24-hour urinary free cortisol, and dexamethasone or CRH stimulation test. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail on these. And you can read more about petrosal sinus sampling here because we don't do it too much, and I think I'm not exactly right on the way I described it before, so I apologize for that. On 27, Cushing, let's see. Sometimes radiographic imaging comes into play here as well, especially when you have the ACTH independent types of Cushing. Then you especially want to look at the adrenal gland, and or, of course, if the ACTH is elevated, you want to look at the pituitary to try and see if there is a pituitary adenoma there. Okay, and then I'm going to skip slide 28, and we're going to go right to 29. And here's where the truth comes out. So the patient was interviewed a little bit further, and they found out that she was also taking some herbal supplements, including some kind of animal adrenal extract, which apparently the authors didn't find out much more about, and black licorice oil. So black licorice oil is what we're going to focus on for now, because this has actually been reported to cause hypertension and hypokalemia, which is, nowadays, it's not so common because black licorice candy, we don't use real licorice root in that anymore. So anyways, consumption of large amounts of black licorice candy has been associated with hypertension and hypokalemia in the past. As I said, most currently available licorice candy is flavored with aniseed rather than licorice root. True licorice root actually contains this biologically active glycyrrhizin. Going to slide 31, you can see that this stuff is sold in all kinds of forms for all kinds of reasons. And glycyrrhizin is a triterpenoid glycosidic saponin. Don't ask me what that is, but that is what they said it was. And it's used as an intense sweetener in candies and for its purported beneficial effects against inflammation, viruses, ulcers, and general GI discomfort. This inhibits the metabolism of cortisol, And that's the way it works. And I'll show you an illustration of that a little bit so we can get at the mechanism of how this stuff works. And it can lead to acute as well as chronic cases of severe hypertension and hyperkalemia like we saw in our current patient. So apparently there's a mineral corticoid receptor in the renal collecting tubules that binds to cortisol as it passes through and aldosterone with equal affinity. Of course, aldosterone is the primary mineral corticoid in the normal kidney because 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2, which is also abundant in renal tubules, actually converts cortisol to cortisone, which has a much, much, much lower affinity for the mineral corticoid receptor. So the thing is, cortisol can act on the same receptor as aldosterone can, but it doesn't in healthy people like us because the cortisol is converted into cortisone in normal functioning kidneys. So that cortisol doesn't have a chance to act on the aldosterone receptor, mineral corticoid receptor. So here's an illustration of that in slide 33, and towards the upper right-hand corner inside this cell here, we can see that cortisol getting converted to cortisone by this 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2. So the cortisone doesn't then act on this MR or mineral corticoid receptor, or cortisone does not. Cortisol can, but like I said, it's converted. And aldosterone is what normally should be acting on the mineral corticoid receptor, and that that goes into the cell nucleus, causes transcription of these proteins for sodium and potassium ATPase, as well as this sodium channel on the left-hand side here as well. And so what happens, aldosterone acts there, you retain sodium. You retain sodium, of course, you retain water, and you become hypertensive in the case of either too much aldosterone or too much cortisol. Okay. And you can just follow along, if you like, on the lower right-hand corner of slide 33. But I'm going to move on to slide 34 for now. So licorice-induced hypertension and hyperkalemia, can be expected on the basis of an increased cortisol-to-cortisone ratio in the urine, which this would reflect the activity of this renal 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase number 2. So you can look at that cortisol-to-cortisone ratio. If there's a significant, I don't know what exactly the normal ratio is, but if there's a significantly higher cortisol than cortisone, then there's a problem with this enzyme. So this can be confirmed by measuring plasma glycyrrhizin concentrations or resolution of symptoms following a licorice withdrawal. Now, I don't know about you guys' lab on Passivant, but our lab here certainly doesn't do glycyrrhizin analysis, and I could not find any reference lab that would measure this either. So I guess if you're faced with this challenge, probably the best thing to do is to have the licorice withdrawn and see how the patient does. And the second best thing is going to be this cortisol to cortisone ratio in the urine. So I don't know if anybody finds a lab that does this glycyrrhizin analysis, I'd be interested to hear about it. So most reports of licorice-induced hypertension demonstrate low serum and aldosterone and renin, just like we saw here. And, of course, you wouldn't be needing to produce too much aldosterone because cortisol is already acting on the aldosterone receptor. You're already retaining sodium, eliminating potassium, and retaining fluid, which leads to hypertension and hypokalemia. So a little bit more on the use of licorice in foods and supplements. Glycyrrhizin has been recognized as safe in the U.S. for more than 20 years, and the glycyrrhizin content of foods and supplements is pretty much unregulated here. Licorice in the U.S. Licorice-containing herbal supplements are an increasingly reported cause of hypertension and hypokalemia, and such supplements can be tablet form. You'll see it as laxatives, licorice tea, and traditional Chinese medicines as people try to look for alternatives to traditional Western medicine. Slide 36, well, how much is too much? The European Union recommends about 100 milligrams per day is the upper limit that they expect. So that's about 60 to 70 grams of licorice. a licorice fluid extract, at least one that they looked at, was found to deliver between 200 and 800 milligrams. So one dose of that already puts people above the EU recommendation. And powdered licorice root contains between anywhere from 40 to 360 in a daily dose. So again, depending on the exact formula, a formulation of the supplement someone's taking, they can easily exceed the upper limit of the daily recommendation. Slide 37, just a little follow-up on the patient. She was discharged home with serum potassium of 2.3 on the following day, and she was given increased potassium supplementation. She was already taking some, but they increased it and had her discontinue taking this black licorice oil, and her serum potassium and total CO2 concentrations normalized, and her hypertension actually decreased. So just in conclusion, a few points that the authors pointed out that they thought were helpful to remember. Glycyrrhizin is contained in licorice-based foods and supplements and inhibits renal metabolism of cortisol to cortisone by 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2. When cortisol is not metabolized, it can actually act in much the same way as aldosterone on the mineralocorticoid receptor in the kidneys. So excessive consumption of glycyrrhizin can lead to hypertension and hypokalemia and should be considered in the differential diagnosis of patients presenting with these findings. And I don't guess your clinicians are going to think about this that often, so this may be an area where the laboratorian can come to the rescue. And licorice-induced hypertension and hypokalemia may be suspected on the basis of this increased cortisol-to-cortisone ratio in urine and can be confirmed by measuring plasma glycyrrhizin concentrations or by resolution of symptoms and lab abnormalities following withdrawal of the glycyrrhizin source. So in summary, this case illustrates licorice-containing supplements as a potential cause for significant hypertension and hypokalemia, and such supplementation should be considered in the differential diagnosis in patients with signs and symptoms of pseudo-hyperaldosteronism or this apparent hyperaldosteronism. So that's going to do it for me. I'd like to thank everybody for participating. If you have any questions, we'll open that up with Robin here.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dufresne. We will have a question and answer period. Does anybody have any questions about this case? It's always a good review ACTH, you know, and in what is produced as a result of that. It is something that I think we probably run across a lot of patient cases due to all different kinds of health situations in that patient. So that was a very good review. So Dr. Freen, I'd like to thank you very much. And also the fact that supplements, having a good patient history and physical is very important. We help the physicians a lot by producing them with the lab results. But without a history and physical, it's really helpful. You need that in order to differentiate exactly what's going on with that patient. Okay. Pasman, do you have any questions?
No, we're fine. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. Big success. They understood everything.
It's so good to hear your voice. I want to thank you, Dr. Dufresne. And our next presentation will be on March the 18th, and Dr. Murphy is going to present. He's going to present cases on histoplasmosis and also cryptococcus. It will be a presentation. And just as a reminder, as far as the audio file for this, the PowerPoint and the audio files for the 2010 Memorial Medical Center Pathology Audio Conference presentations are available on the PACI website now under Education Materials. Go to www.pacipath.com. Before viewing the files, it's best to save the files to your computer or to a flash drive. An audio file from today's presentation will be posted on the PACI website in about a week to be used by staff that were unable to attend, or if you would like to review the presentation from today at a later time. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.